From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
Craig Needles Podcast, Friday Roundtable, here on a snowy and cold Friday on Richmond Row. As I look out onto the street, nothing's been plowed yet, cars are covered in snow, but thankfully, our Roundtable panel will got here safely. So we are joined in the studio by former Thames Centre Deputy Mayor Kelly Elliott, former London City Councillor Roger Carancy, and Jennifer Dunn, the Executive Director of the London Abuse Women's Centre. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Hello.
I'm wonderful, Roger, yourself.
Fine. I just think of this as a white sandy beach when I look outside.
Yeah.
There's no water, but it's a white sandy beach.
There is a little bit of sun, which is good. There will be water on Wednesday when it's supposed to be like 7 degrees and raining. So everything we're seeing now is going to go away. Let's talk about a few issues this week. And the one thing that kind of made the most news locally, or at the very least a lot of people were asking me about it locally, was a planning meeting at City Hall. And typically, people don't love to talk about planning meetings. And Roger and Kelly, you've both sat through your share of planning meetings. And, you know, they're not always super exciting.
It's my favorite.
I love it. Come on.
They were my favorite.
I will ask either of you, have you ever had a uniformed police officer show up at a planning meeting when you were on council?
I haven't. I said one thing. As soon as I saw it, I thought to myself, why are they wearing their uniform? And I'm going to say this straight up front. I don't think she did it purposely. I think
we don't know. The police are going to look into it.
Yeah, but, yeah. I don't think there was an understanding on her part as to that you shouldn't wear that uniform when you're there. But it was different. And I would say this, that I think that had somebody done it during our tenure, we may have spoken up and said something about it. And maybe some of the counselors obviously didn't know that it's not kosher to do. So it did surprise me. It shouldn't be done. And I think the police have been responsible in saying, yes, they're going to look into it. And I think education on behalf of the constable's part is probably going to come down to what it'll end up being and helping her understand that you don't do that type of thing at council meeting or at committee or council meetings. So
yeah. Kelly, have you ever seen that?
I have never seen that, no. And I think, the tweets that came out from AJ pointing out the fact that it is against the Police Services Act for this not to happen was important to and led to this conversation. And I think it's important that it's brought up. And, you know, maybe she didn't do it intentionally, but that uniform brings a sense of authority and expertise to the conversation. And she specifically spoke in regards to concerns she had about traffic in that neighborhood and having a uniformed police officer stand there talking about traffic, you know, can lead council members and the general public to believe, you know, she has that expertise in this matter and brings that level of conversation up. And so there is a reason why it is not allowed and she should absolutely, you know, she has every right to bring those conversations as a concerned citizen, as a member of that neighborhood. But the fact that she brought her uniform into it is definitely not appropriate.
No, and you don't want to do that. And I watched that meeting, and it just came off to me as just sounding pretty ridiculous. Jen, did you see much of that story, and what were your thoughts on it?
Actually, I agree with Kelly 100%. But also, you'd think that being a police officer, you should have a basic understanding of code of conduct, what is allowed and what's not allowed. Like, wouldn't that... Like, isn't that just a given? Like, I know some people maybe don't know all of the rules, sure, but you should have a basic understanding of that kind of thing. But yeah, it put her in a position of power and authority just by wearing the uniform. And then on top of that, we need more housing in the city. I don't know. I know traffic and all of that. She probably had some really good reasons to be arguing it, but... It's hard when everyone is like, we need more housing, we need more housing, and you see that.
And this is what I kept saying.
Welcome to the world of planning.
Yes.
This is what I say. If she had shown up to that meeting and said 75% of the stuff that she had said, I would have disagreed with a lot of it, but I've been like, okay, you know, that's how she feels. But when you do it wearing a police uniform, it's a completely different thing. It changes the entire tone and tenor of what it is you're talking about. So I have a hard time with people saying, well, she has the right to go there and speak. But yeah, no one's disputing that she does. It's just how you do it. And you can't wear that uniform to go do that. And like Jen said, we need housing in this community. We need housing in a big way. So when we have, and I played the clip on the podcast earlier this week, we have a guy standing up there saying, hey, we don't want to have 2 5-unit townhouses here. Why can't we just have $3 million homes on this piece of land? I've got some news. There's a lot of people that can't afford $1 million homes, right? Like, and I don't think that should be a controversial statement. Like, we can't just say, well, let's just build a bunch of $1 million homes instead. That's not a way to solve the problem, Roger.
No, I agree. I mean, I'm involved in it in some of the things that I do, whether it's through my real estate or through my personal holdings. What they're trying to do on that particular site is exactly what the city has asked them to do.
Right.
And that's intensification. And so when you hear things from some parts of the city where all these things come, and you know, Kelly, you've sat in a ton of meetings of planning meeting, and you hear these things over and over and over again. And when a project gets green lighted and goes ahead, those issues are never really an issue. And the one that gets me all the time is our property values. Listen, unless you're living next door to a dump, animal rendering plant, or a pollution plant, your property values likely do not go down, especially over the last few years where you've seen, you know, monumental increases in property. So a lot of what you hear are what people think. I think what their research of the issues is not very well researched. It's just things that they think may happen. So you have to take it as a member of council or a member of planning committee, you've got to take it all with a grain of salt. People have to come, they get their emotions out, they bring these arguments forward, and most of the time they're not valid arguments. I've always said, you know, there's a piece of property I'm involved in right now. We're doing some planning for it out in the east end of the city. The questions we get asked out in that part of the city are so much different from any other part of the city. We get asked, when are you going to build it? How much of the rent's going to be? How quickly can we get in? Not, no, don't build it here and don't do things. It's a different a different way of doing things in various parts of the city.
And I would agree with Roger in the fact that what's coming in this application is exactly what the city's asking for. It's exactly what we need. I'm a huge proponent on intensification, on increasing density within urban growth boundaries, because that's how we protect our agricultural lands. You know, when we avoid that sprawl and we build housing within cities and within towns, and not just in the city of London, but in Thorndale and Dorchester and Lucan and out in the county, we have to utilize what we have within our urban growth boundaries and increase those densities. And I've always been a huge proponent of that, much to my demise this past October. I've been vocal on it. And the same thing that happens in the city of London happens in every community. It happened in Temp Center over and over and over again about how, you know, we need these big single family houses in our communities, and the reality is that's just not attainable anymore. We can't do that anymore. And you know, I'll speak specifically to one subdivision that was having another subdivision come beside of it. And they were built, those houses were built 30, 40 years ago when you needed your own well and your own septic bed. So they were big lots because that's what you needed. You don't need that anymore. You don't need these large lots anymore. And I think, Craig, to your point, when you made a tweet after this application, that if you say it doesn't fit into the neighborhood, your argument should just be automatically thrown out because, you know, that's not a valid point.
No. You yourself don't get to decide what fits and doesn't fit into a neighborhood.
Yeah, but I'm going to go a little further. And Kelly, you and I agree on some things, maybe a lot more than people think. But that's one you can build. The city does require more lands for people to build. What is happening, the cost of housing now, one of the main reasons it is high is because of the fact that we don't have a lot of new land in the city for newer homes to be built. There's the urban growth boundary, I think, is going to be stretched to its limit very soon. Very soon, if not already. The city here is going through the exercise, I think, starting this year, of looking at expanding that urban growth boundary. So the more we do that, the more we restrict that type of development. And again, who am I to tell somebody if they want a larger lot over a smaller lot? It's not up to me to tell them. You know, you're not going to tell, I don't think, most families who have 3-4 kids or 2 kids, I think they want a backyard. They don't want to raise their kids on the 20th floor of a condo tower. So there's different lifestyles for different people. the builders probably are better to tell us what the market tells them. Mm-hmm. We as real estate agents understand what the market is. There's all sorts of people and what they're looking for. But as long as we build homes, that's a good thing. There has to be a variety and a selection of different types of styles to build. I understand your concern with expanding urban growth boundary. I get it. But again, by doing that, and what London has done with the London plan has restricted that type of newer growth, and that is what drives prices up. If there's no land to expand and build on the single family homes, you're going to see the price.
But I think prices go higher. No, and I agree with you, Roger, in that fact. But I think where I'm coming from is if we're just going to expand the urban growth boundary and not intensify it, the same thing. It definitely goes hand in hand. But if we're just going to keep building single family houses and expanding the growth boundary just to do that and not doing infill projects like this, that's where we're running into problems.
Yep. No, I get it.
Do you think that there's an attitude in the city, Jen, about, like, some people are very much pro-intensification, they want to see more housing, but it's always, well, I don't want the housing in my neighborhood. Like, isn't that kind of just the vibe that we get from this stuff?
Yeah, totally. That is like a huge theme. I was at a meeting this morning and we were talking about how there are certain conversations in the city around too many social services in certain parts of the city and stuff like that. And I'm like, what does that even mean? Doesn't that mean that there's a need in that area of the city? Maybe. Does it mean that it's easily accessible? And I know this is way off topic.
No, it's not.
But it's
a similar topic. You're right.
And I'm like, I just don't understand. People deserve a safe place to live. It doesn't matter if that's in Old East or the East End or the West End, North, South. Mm-hmm. There needs to be affordable housing everywhere.
Well, I remember when your office at London Abuse Women's Center moved to where it is, which is York Street, right?
Yeah, we moved from York Street.
Yeah, from York Street to York Street.
Yeah, down the street.
York Street. Yeah. But I remember that happened. And there was the standard, well, there's another social service agency in East London, I don't know if it's bad to have London Abuse Women's Center close by.
Yeah.
Like, why do we assume that it is?
Well,
like,
and guess what?
Yeah.
There was parking. It's on a bus route. Yep. There's like other things in the parking lot. So like if a woman needs to be safe about coming to or be maybe a little bit thinking more about where she's going, there's other places that she could be going if somebody's following her.
Yep.
Like we were downtown before. There was no parking. Yes, it was on a bus route. There was no parking. It was virtually impossible for people that drove to access the center. So all of that needs to be included in those types of conversations as well, right?
Yeah.
And I just want to say to anyone who thinks that we shouldn't be providing these services in North London, South London, West London, in every neighborhood in London that requires it, so the services are where the people are, should also not be complaining when people from Middlesex County and Oxford and Elgin are coming into London, because that's the only place that you're putting up resources.
You're right there. That's a whole other story too, where those smaller centers, should they be providing those services for people that live in those places?
Yes.
I mean, you know, giving somebody a bus ticket and say, go to London and take advantage of the services there, it does put a strain on the local services here. And there are so many services. And where you guys are, it doesn't matter where you are. The problems are all over the city.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's not just in one area. So you locate where you go. You've got a great landlord there too, but services go where services are needed. That's plain and simple.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like for a service like London Abuse Women's Center, or there was the piece that the folks over at CTV did this week about safe space, and there were people in Old East saying, "Well, we don't want safe space here. Where do you want safe space?" Like, where do you think it needs to go? Like, I'm not saying that, you know, Old East Village is the only place where safe space would make sense, but it's a place where safe space makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, where do you want it if it's not going to be where it is right now?
Somebody else's backyard.
Yeah, exactly. Just put it downtown or put it over here. Like, safe space, in my estimation, could go anywhere in the city and be an effective place. But there are spots on a bus route, easily accessible for people who may want to go there, that make more sense. And I think that where they are makes sense. So I never understand the pushback to have more housing here. I never understand the pushback to more services here. It's all about, I want to not see this so I can pretend it's not happening.
Yeah.
That's that honestly is a huge part of it. I want to not see this near where I live because that way I can pretend this is not something that happens in my community. And you can just stick your head in the sand and think everything's okay. That's all it is. That's all it is. And that is not true. There are people that need safe space or London Women's Women's Center or, you know, pick one of our social services in this community. There are people that need those places. And it's sad, but it's true. I want to talk about another topic real quick. Shift gears to politics here. And we saw the letter that got posted from various members of the Liberal Party, including some folks that are high profile in this community. Deb Matthews signed on to it, Jesse Elmer, former Deputy Mayor Kate Graham, saying, hey, what we want is Mike Schreiner to leave the Green Party of Ontario and come be the leader of the Ontario Liberal Party, which there was a lot that I went through my head when that happened. And I very much like Mike Schreiner. I'm a big fan. I think that he's someone who I very much respect as a politician and as an ideas person. But the whole thing just seemed weird. Roger, what was your reaction to it?
Listen, I'm not here speaking as a liberal. I'm an atheist now when it comes to politics. I will say this. Whoever wants to run can run. Mm-hmm. Those who say just bring him here and he should be the leader, I think, are wrong. That shows a disrespect towards democracy and the party, the members of the party who make that decision. I know an article that you sent as reference, and one thing that I've said for many, many years. There are certain parties that say things knowing full well that those things will never be attainable because you do have to pass things. Hopefully you want to do it as consensus. And Mr. Schreiner is one of those people. He's very bright. He's a very nice guy. Very, very nice man. But if he wants to be the leader of the Liberal Party, or if people want him in the Liberal Party, put his name forward as leadership candidate, go through the rigorous things that you have to go through, face the people, face the members of the party, tell them what you want to do, just as everybody else, because there are other people that are interested in being a part of it who have been with the Liberal Party for many, many years, and they've toiled there and made the party what it is, whether that's a good thing or bad thing today, that's up to individuals, but nobody is stopping anybody from putting their name down to run. But to crown somebody, you know, to say that they're going to be the leader of the party, that's disrespectful to every member of the party. And those who have signed on to anoint him as the leader, I think they realize or they understand a little better that you shouldn't do something like that. I'm surprised that they would actually put their name saying, just make this guy party leader. I think that's wrong.
I'm going to use that atheist, political atheist. I have no skin in the game in any of these parties, but, and I agree to Kate Graham's point that we need to do politics differently, but I don't think this is doing politics differently by any means. I honestly was very put off by the superior complex that the Liberal Party thinks they have, that Mike Schreiner should give up everything, his values in the Green Party
and
everything.
That's just some people in the Liberal Party.
Some people in the Liberal Party.
And the names that were mentioned.
That think that Mike Schreiner should give up his values in the Green Party and the work that he's done in the Green Party and his leadership in the Green Party, he should just pop over and go to the Liberal Party because, you know, what does the Ontario Liberal Party right now have to offer that is so much better than
seven more seats in the Green Party?
They don't have party status.
That's literally the difference.
To be frank, Mike Schreiner has the same chances of being premier as the leader of the Green Party that he does the leader of the Liberal Party coming into the next election. Like, there is nothing that benefits Mike Schreiner to move over to be the leader of the Liberal Party. And this, again, the superior complex that the Liberal Party is so much better than the Green Party for Mike Schreiner to be a part of was really off-putting to me. And frankly, I would say to any of those people that signed that letter, like, if you think Mike Schreiner is so great as a leader, which I absolutely do, I think he's fantastic, go to the Green Party.
They're selling memberships.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they're not hard to get.
You asked what's good about the Liberal Party. I like the color. I like that.
It's not a good aesthetic, visually. Yeah.
My favorite color is green, so if we're going by that.
I don't get on a lot of levels. One, Mike Schreiner has kind of made his bones in politics as, I want to do things differently than the three main parties. I'm kind of the outsider. I feel differently because that's why the guy joined the Green Party. So if you all of a sudden, if you're Mike Schreiner at the first opportunity, you're like, oh, actually, you know what? I'm in the Liberals now. Like, what the hell does that do for your brand? Nothing. Like, nothing. And I don't get the thought process that, hey, this is going to make the Liberal Party better. This is better for Mike Schreiner. And maybe it would make the Liberal Party better. But at some point, are we sure that this is a party that's going to be competitive in the next election? They have 8 seats. And I think that the NDP's next leader, Merritt Stiles, is someone who I think is going to do quite well. I don't know if she's going to be premier. There's still a lot of time to figure that out. But I don't see the NDP as being weaker in the next election. In fact, if anything, they're going to be stronger. I think that the province kind of thought that, all right, Andrea Horvath has kind of reached her ceiling here. Maybe they're going to feel differently about Merritt Stiles. We'll see. But I don't see what the upside was. Jen, do you think that voters would respond to that sort of party shifting and that party switching in your estimation?
I think that it's all ridiculous, to be honest. I'm like, this guy is a green for a reason.
Yeah.
Like what? Yeah. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I think that if it doesn't make sense to me, then it won't make sense to other voters either. And it's just strange at the end of the day, right?
Like, I don't get it.
I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't get it either. And I was trying to wrap my head around it. And look, there's a long time between now and the next provincial election. A bet that I would consider making, depending on the odds that we're getting, is I think that all three parties may have different leaders the next time that we go to the polls provincially. I think that Doug Ford may no longer be the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario. I think that's a strong possibility. And if that's the case, Mike Schreiner is going to be the only one who's been through a campaign that's at the leadership of his party. That might be a groovy position to be in. And again, I'm not saying that a Doug Ford resignation is imminent or anything along those lines, but for the most part, I think that when you've been premier for 8 years, and you can ask Dalton McGuinty about this, at some point you say, it's time for me to go because the province is, they've had enough of me. And I think that Ford might be making that decision a couple years from now. Either way, I don't see what the upside is here for anyone. And look, I think that the Liberals have some interesting internal candidates. Like, you know, Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, I think, is like, he's already a member of the Liberal Party. Perhaps that's the sort of person you should be looking at for the leader, someone who's already purchased a membership. I do think, and I've talked to several Liberals about it, the day that letter came out, I got notes or text messages from various people involved in the Ontario Liberal Party, be it in London, outside of London, Toronto, wherever it was, saying to me, this is just kind of, all this is doing is saying that, hey, we don't have anyone who works here now who's capable of doing this job. That's how it comes off.
As twice trying to be leader of the Liberal Party, or was it once? Maybe Kate Graham wants to try leadership of the Green Party. I don't know.
Maybe
she wants to
maybe that's
get
the
him
plan.
Out.
Get Schreiner out of there. It's a house of cards situation.
Just thinking outside the box, as they say.
But that, to me, I think is a pretty reasonable argument from, and I saw a group of Ontario Greens said, yeah, we think Mike Schreiner is a great leader too. Here's a link to buy a membership. I think that's a good response from the Green Party in Ontario. We'll see what actually happens with it. I suspect that Mike Schreiner is going to continue to be the leader of the Green Party, but stranger things have occurred. One thing I want to also ask about before we wrap up here. In fact, I want to do two more stories. One, we all would have seen that Bobby Hull died this week. Bobby Hull is one of the greatest goal scorers in the history of the National Hockey League. Bobby Hull also assaulted at least two of his wives. Bobby Hull also took time out of his day from time to time to talk about what great ideas Hitler had. Not a very good person. And the folks in the media were kind of getting raked no matter what they did. The outlets that acknowledged that Bobby Hull wasn't a very good person were getting kind of blasted for saying, well, wait a minute, we should be talking about the man's life here and we don't speak ill of the dead. The outlets that didn't talk about Bobby Hull's off-ice stuff were getting blasted for ignoring the elephant in the room, which was Bobby Hull did these terrible things. I'm more on the side of when someone dies, we just tell the truth about that person. We tell objective truths, and one of those things is Bobby Hull not a very good guy. How should the media handle it, Jen, when someone who is not a good person dies?
I think that everybody probably should have known, if they didn't already, about his past and behaviors before he died. I think that the NHL has a better job, or that needs to do a better job with this kind of thing. And the fact that Gary oh my goodness, Gary Bettman.
There you go.
Didn't even acknowledge any of, I mean, why would he? It's all about money, and he was the greatest goal scorer, and that's the end of it for them, right? I mean, you have to look at the way that these people are idolized. They are Bobby Hall. So many people would have looked up to him. So many kids who played hockey. Everyone knows who he is. You mention his name, you know, you can connect it to hockey. Well, you have to be a good person off the ice too. Mm-hmm. Period.
Yeah.
You have to be held to the same standards as everyone else. If someone was abusive, racist, whatever else in your line of work, Craig, do you think they'd last very long?
Probably not.
I don't particularly think so. So the fact that the NHL was making so much money over how many goals he scored or whatever, that's, you know, just sweep it under the rug. And, you know, the NHL is the only professional sports organization that does not have a sexual assault or domestic violence policy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yes, they have to do sexual violence and domestic violence training and all of that, but that's like an hour long, maybe once a year if we're lucky. More needs to be done.
Yeah.
I think, Jen, I'm glad you led off this conversation. And I think that, you know, as we're having a national conversation on sports culture that exists within Canada and not just in hockey, but across the board, the same day Bobby Hall passed away, Karen Vecchio, the MP for Elgin Middlesex London, who was also the chair of the Status of Women Committee. And, you know, I know she's a huge supporter of you, Jen, and your organization. She's a huge advocate for changing sports culture in Canada. She was in committee that day with, I believe his name is Ian Ross, but I could be wrong, but from Jim Cann. Questioning the allegations that exist, the sexual abuse allegations that exist right now in Gymnastics Canada, you know, and taking this very seriously. And at the same time this was happening, her provincial counterparts, our MPP in Elgin Middlesex London, put on social media a huge tribute to Bobby Hall. And I know they were good friends and whatever, but he called him a Canadian sports legend. And I think that's, you know, it shows where we put our values. If we are valuing changing sports culture and the abuse that exists within our sports culture that has been okay to exist for so long, but then we're, like you said, Jen, idolizing people like Bobby Hall because he was a fantastic hockey player, I think it really shows where our values lie. Do we really value the work that you, Jen, and your organization and organizations across the country do? Do we value the work that Karen Vecchio and other MPs are doing to hold account these organizations that have allowed abuse for so long? And then we turn around at the same time and idolize someone like Bobby Hall. I think you're absolutely right, Jen, in the fact that if we are going to hold up people because they're great sports, they're great at sports, they also have to be great people off the ice. And for me, raising kids who are also hockey players, I hope they idolize people who are just good people. I don't care if they're good at sports or whatever that. Like, their role models need to be good people.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's as far as, like, what the organization, what the league does about this, Bobby Hall, of course, is most famous for playing for Chicago Blackhawks. He also spent some time in Winnipeg, and that's fine. But the Blackhawks are probably the last organization the league wants having this conversation surrounding, for obvious reasons with the Kyle Beach situation. Roger, what do you think the media should do when someone like this passes away?
Okay, here's my story. I met Bobby Hall once on the 401 with my family, driving to, I think it was Niagara Falls. We stopped in at one of the service centers, and lo and behold, there was Bobby Hall at the McDonald's putting in an order. And I said to my son, I said, this guy, Nathan was very small. Mm-hmm. He was 4 or 5 years old. I mentioned to him who he was. I walked up to him. He was very nice, you know, for an autograph, you know, very nice smile on his face, asking some questions. I guess what I'm going to say, I understand. I get it. This is not something where I praise the guy.
No,
he had faults. When do we stop, or if we do, when do we stop continuing to call people something that they did many years ago, have hopefully stopped doing, have changed their ways? And I know that there's educational programs out there for men who do that type of thing. And do we throw those people aside and say, you know what, you've done it once, which is abhorrent what they've done? And if they've...
Now, in his case, it was multiple times with multiple wives.
Many, many years ago.
Yes.
And again, I'm not putting an excuse forward for him. I'm just trying to weigh this out in my mind.
Yeah, where does it...
When does it end that the person, you know, no matter what you did, you're a bad person always? Yeah. I mean, there are advocates for various... against various crimes who were the worst abusers of those various crimes who have become the best advocates in helping people change their ways.
To me, here's where the line is. Public recognition of what you've done and saying, look, I did a thing here that wasn't very good and I'm sorry and I'm changing and I'm going to do better.
Yep.
And that never really, that never really came with him. And that to me is when it goes from, do we hold this against you? Is when you say, hey, look, I screwed up here. I did something I shouldn't have done.
Yep.
Right.
And so the public acknowledgement has to come forward. Yep. Is what you're saying. The Hitler issue that we haven't even mentioned here is, that's abhorrent to everybody also. No matter what he did, it's bad.
Yeah.
And it should never be done. You never do that. I don't understand why, somebody goes that far and does something like that. But I'm just saying, when do, and you know, we take Bobby Hull out of the equation here. Yes, when somebody dies, I agree. You tell them the good and the bad. But you don't keep saying we shouldn't talk about the good because he's done bad.
Right.
You can't say that.
I thought the Athletic did a good piece on it that Mark Lazarus wrote where he said, hey, here's the good.
Yep.
One of the greatest hockey players ever lived. But you should also know, and let's not forget, here's the bad.
And you should. And again, as you said, if there's no public acknowledgement, and he could have been somebody, possibly, and I don't know, Jen, this is better for you to answer, would you use somebody like that if they changed your way, said, you know what I did was something that should never be done by anybody? Do you use somebody that way to help educate others not to do that?
Well, I think it depends on the situation. I can think of a couple instances where at the London Abused Women's Center, we've been offered money, for example, or opportunities by individuals or businesses or whoever to do better, or because they're thinking they're doing better. Well, money's not the answer. You need to put your money where your mouth is. So you know who I like to reference in this example is our landlord, who you brought up before. The owner of the London Lightning, for example. Vito Frisia is a huge supporter of our work. And he means it when he says it. If something happens on his team, the right steps are taken, conversations take place. And the thing with Bobby Hull and hockey, could Bobby Hull have taken a different path and maybe not done it again and again and again, maybe learned a thing or two, maybe spoke to young men, boys, about what he did and how it's maybe not a good idea to do those kinds of things. Yeah, but that didn't happen, and it continues to not happen. We're talking about Hockey Canada still, and I know I'm focused on hockey. Kelly, you had mentioned other sports, and that's true as well. But there's no change. There's no change, and that's the problem, right? Mm. So yeah, you. There needs to come a time where we can be like, you know, yeah, this guy was a good hockey player, and he did this too, and it was bad. Mm. And I don't think, like, I'm not suggesting he wasn't a good hockey player, but what he did was bad. And the women on the other side of this have to live a lifelong sentence and look over their shoulder or have all this safety planning just to live their lives. And this guy gets recognized in a public forum for, you know, scoring goals.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the conversation regarding the media and how he's portrayed in the media, because when you idolize someone like Bobby Hull, you know, you ignore all of that happened, and you essentially just wipe it away like it never happened. And I think in order to make change, and Jenny, you're the expert on this, we need to have these hard conversations. We need to have these conversations about Bobby Hall to say we can't keep wiping this away. We can't keep hiding it. We can't keep idolizing just because he was a great hockey player and ignoring everything that else that happened. And maybe it, you know, some people don't like that, you know, Bobby Hall might be made an example of. But the fact of the matter is we have to have these conversations, and the status of and I brought up the status of the Women Committee. They're having these conversations. But when you have, you know, the women doing the heavy lifting of doing this work and bringing this all to light, and then having their, you know, their colleagues turn around and praise them and ignore all the rest of it, it's really doing a disservice to the conversations that we're having.
Mm-hmm. And what a missed opportunity for the NHL. It's not like they didn't know what was going on. I mean, he was in a lot of trouble back then. Mm-hmm. Like, they could have helped him. They could have supported him, and then they could have used his voice for younger players.
The guy, and this is well documented, the guy was a big drinker. Mm-hmm. Like, and drinking and violence often go together. So if there was a substance abuse program in the National Hockey League in the 1970s, perhaps this doesn't go the way that it did with him as far as his relationships go. And to Roger's point, and the last thing on this is, I'm not about like, oh yeah, let's just toss this person because they've done this one thing, depending on what the thing is, and then we have no use for them ever again. But to me, if we're going to sort of talk about what they did in a different light, they've just got to come out and say, hey, look, I own what you did. Say, I shouldn't have done this. This is wrong, and I was wrong, and I'm going to try to make this better. And that to me is if that's step one, and if you're not doing that, then it sort of comes off as though you're kind of doubling down on that behavior. So last thing before we wrap up, viral video this week. Farmer talking about Ontario's Canada supply management system dumping milk down a drain. It gets shared all over the place, and people are upset about supply management, which I think there are some very valid criticisms of supply management, but I want to be clear. I just don't know if this is one of them. Kelly, what was your reaction to the video?
Yes, I've been very vocal on Twitter about this. So I think you're absolutely right. Supply management is not a perfect.
No.
not perfect by any means. But this viral video, for those that didn't see it, was a Southern Ontario farmer, a dairy farmer, who was dumping raw milk out, essentially on a huge rant about why supply management sucks because he has to dump milk. It was picked up by the food professor, which I hate to call him that because I have very little respect for him. but it was picked up by him, went viral, and essentially turned into a big bash on Canadian dairy farmers. And I think it's just, that farmer was a very big disservice to the dairy industry and to Canadian farmers. Dumping milk happens in every country, in everywhere. It's not a supply management thing. I think people often forget, you know, milk doesn't come from the cow and then go into the bag and carton and then end up in the grocery store. There's processors. Processors can only handle so much milk, and it's a fresh product. If they can't sell that product, they're not going to produce more in order just to go bad on shelves. And so sometimes things get ended up dumped out if the processor can't process it and sell it. And that's what happens. It happens in the States more than it does in Canada, because in Canada we have supply management that controls supply and demand. And so for this farmer to do this, and I think there's just so much disinformation and misinformation happening and misleading the public on what happens in our dairy industry. You know, there's been a lot of outrage that milk should have been donated to food banks. Again, that's raw milk. It's illegal. And technically, raw milk is illegal in Canada. It can't be distributed. So if there's no processor to process it, it can't go to food banks. But on the flip side of that, Ontario Dairy actually donates over 1 million liters of milk every year to food banks. Every month, there is the Ontario Milk Program, where milk gets donated and distributed to over 200 food banks across the province. And so that's already happening. It's, you know, dairy farmers are already donating milk. So it's just, it was really frustrating to watch it go across social media and go across to many people who don't understand the dairy industry.
Yeah, it was. It was the sort of thing that's just kind of designed to go viral. And obviously the guy did it with the intention of like, look at me, everybody on the internet, here's what I'm doing. Like, And so much of that stuff, obviously, you have to peel just a little bit of the layer back to realize that, hey, maybe it's not quite exactly what it seems. All right, let's wrap up there. Thank you very much to Kelly and to Roger and to Jennifer for coming in and having a conversation with us this week. Thanks very much to you for listening. Of course, you can download the Craig Needles podcast at londonnewstoday.ca, classicrock981.com, and wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Plus, please continue to rate, subscribe, and do all those other lovely things for the Craig Needles podcast as well. Have a wonderful weekend, and hopefully maybe you can be listening to us while digging out of the snow. And we will talk to you next week here on the Craig Needles podcast.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.